Welcome. It's precisely 1 o'clock. The House Judiciary Session, we're convened in attendance for Representative Gruenberg, Representative Lynn, Representative Coghill, myself, Representative Ramirez, Vice Chair Dahlstrom, Representative Samuels, Representative Holmes. In attendance today, we have the governor's husband, Todd Palin. We're delighted to have you here, Mr. Palin. And we have before us House Bill 109. This is an issue that was quite central to the campaign and to all Alaskans. And we are delighted and very honored to have Governor Palin here to open testimony on this. She's in a hurry today because it's also a very important occasion. As Representative Gruenberg pointed out to me, it's the governor and Todd's daughter's 6th birthday party at kindergarten. So we are measuring our priorities with that, Governor. We'd be delighted to have you before the committee. Thank you so much for honoring us today with your presence.
Thank you. Well, I thank you for allowing me just a couple of minutes here at the most, taking your precious time to thank you sincerely for addressing HB 109. Thank you. I think that this is, as you pointed out, a significant gesture for the state of Alaska right now. Yes, I campaigned on open, honest, transparent government. I know that so many candidates did. I think that Alaskans are expecting ethics reform, and you all are doing the right thing, also being very passionate about this. An effort here that I believe is very sincere in working together across both sides of the aisle, administrative branch, working with legislative branch. I appreciate this. Also, the senators who have been very passionate about this. Also, Senator French for moving this forward, also an ethics reform package. So I just want to thank you very much. And anything that I can do also to assist you all as you add to or amend or make the bill better, anything that I can do to help in that arena, please let me know. And with that, I just want to introduce to you, many of you already know him from Department of Law, Dave Jones, kind of our ethics guru, who will be discussing the bill with you and taking your questions also. Thank you for pointing out that my schedule did include being invited to a kindergarten class today at 1:30, so we'll hustle on over there for that. But truly, from all Alaskans who are ready for ethics reform in state government so that we can build a foundation of trust. As we build a foundation of trust here in state government, building upon that, then the projects, the programs, the missions that Alaskans need and want for a better living here in Alaska, we can build upon that in the manner that Alaskans so deserve. So thank you for helping to build that foundation here. And with that, Dave Jones. Thanks.
Thank you, Governor Palin.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dave Jones. I am an Assistant Attorney General with the State of Alaska. And as the Governor mentioned, I'm here to help out as we work together toward ethics reform in our joint goal of assuring Alaskans and reassuring them of the integrity of their public officials.
Thank you. Mr. Jones. We are delighted to have you here. Your reputation precedes you. You're very highly regarded by this body as well as the other. We look forward to working with you. And if I may, I'd like to lay out for the committee members and the public what our intention is this week, since we are just taking up the fine piece of work that you assisted Chairman Lynn and members of his State Affairs Committee on drafting. Our intention is to take up the ethics bill Monday through Friday of this week from 1 o'clock until 3 o'clock, and we will, as we work through the broad architecture of the bill today, we will try and lay out what our plans are for the ensuing days, very specifically to inform the public as well as the members of that process. And then our hope is that by Thursday we can determine whether we can finish this bill by 3 p.m. On Friday, as is our intention, to have this work completed by the end of this week, or whether we'll have to take some vitamins and start working through the afternoon and into the evening on Friday because we're resolute in moving this bill intact with integrity, efficiency, but with due speed, with input from the public, with excellent input from you and the administration, as well as the work that Representative Coghill did in the subcommittee, and the work that was stewarded by Chairman Lynn and Representative Gruenberg as the ranking Democrat in the House State Affairs Committee. So I thank the three of you. I do appreciate you making some opening remarks, but our intention this afternoon is to have Representative Coghill take us through the work that was done, and then to have you assist, and then to lay out after the members on this committee, myself included, that are less well versed on what's in House Bill 109, than to lay out a broader architecture as we proceed tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, is our hope. So if you'll make a brief introduction, and then we will defer to Representative Coghill. And it's a pleasure to have you here. You have established an excellent, extraordinary reputation for leading us through this process, so we thank you in advance for your assistance.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I want to lend my voice to the thanks to the members of the State Affairs Committee, and particularly the members of the Ethics Subcommittee. They did a lot of heavy lifting on some very tough subjects, and so we all owe them a great debt of gratitude. I will dispense with any description of the provisions of the bill, because I understand from your comments that Representative Coghill intends to take up that additional piece of heavy lifting. But if there's anything I can do to assist along the way, I'm here to offer that help. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir. And you're welcome to sit there, because I think Representative Coghill is going to lead the Judiciary Committee from here. Mm-hmm. And so we would be delighted for your input. And I'm good at eye contact, so if you see something that needs to be supplemented to Representative Coghill's presentation, if you want to catch his eye or the chair's eye, we'd be glad to. I'll put a touch on his forearm and let you inject interject. Yeah, right.
Mr. Chair, before we start,
Representative Gruenberg.
You're looking good today, Mr. Cox.
At the discretion of the chair, those comments will be allowed. You do look good, Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is that debatable?
No. No. That's for those who get to watch this, I complained on the floor that we've been overdoing that. So. And I think it was started by your own chairman of the Judiciary Committee.
Civility, Representative Coghill, is godliness, then ethics, then civility.
All right. The packet you have before us deals with the O version of CS for House Bill 109 that came out of State Affairs. And in front of the packet, I have a color-coded sectional that I'm going to go through. But before we do that, if you'll turn over to tab 3 on your packet. This goes through some definitions. And it became apparent to me after talking to a few people as we're coming into this that it would be nice if we had the definitions in a alphabetical order and easily gotten to. And so, for example, what is a lobbyist? What is a family member? What is financial interest? What is an immediate family member over against other family members? What is a supervisor, etc.?
If I could just interrupt for a moment, I was so impressed when I perused this packet, and I just want to thank publicly Jane Pearson and Reneva Moss for putting this together. It's an extraordinarily well-organized, structured document that provides us these points of reference, so I just wanted to thank them right at the outset, Dennis. Appreciate your help and Reneva's help enormously. A fantastic document. You go ahead, Mr. Representative.
And the thanks is well-deserved, Mr. Chairman. The question came up several times, what do we mean by that? And so I thought we better get the definitions right up front. And I think that the administration also is going to be helped with this, because I think we asked them many times, okay, what does that mean again? So I think Dave will appreciate that. What I propose to do, Mr. Chairman, is go through a sectional that is a little unorthodox. Because it doesn't go through the sections exactly numerically. It goes by numerical by topic. And what I did was I color-coded the topics for my benefit that I hope that you'll get some benefit from. The bill that we have before us, House Bill 109, the Senate's, the governor's bill, deals with legislative ethics, it deals with lobbying regulations, it deals with what family members can do, and finally deals with membership of the legislature, for example, our staff, those who work in have to report or can't accept gifts, etc. So the legislative section, that's normally falls under Title 24. We do deal with some Title 15 issues, which are, again, APOC reporting issues. And the first page of this is, it's blue because it deals primarily with legislators reporting, primarily under Title 24. Do you have this, Max?
You're referring to tab 1 now?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Tab 1. Sorry.
Yes, I do. Sure.
And the reason I went to tab 3 is because we'll probably get into definitions. I wanted you to be able to turn there quickly. Oh, the bill is actually in right behind this sectional.
Yeah.
So, and before I go through each section, what I'd like to do is at least introduce why I've got them color-coded this way.
Yeah, because I didn't understand.
Yeah. And so the first part has to do with candidates, lobbyists, representatives, legislative staff, and things that we must report. And so this really deals, I think, with what is ethical and what is not ethical. For the most part, the first 28 sections of the bill deal with that. And if you go to page 2 of this, you'll see a different color code, which is kind of an orange colored. And this deals with public officials reporting. And you'll notice a public official is defined back here. We'll get to it. But it deals primarily with title that deals with executive ethics. And so this, once again, is just dealing with APOC and their ethics reporting requirements. So it deals with some of the issues we're going to get real sticky, like what should an attorney general do under certain circumstances? What is significant, what is not significant income? And some of the more interesting issues. Then if you go to page 3, it's the things, once again, you'll see that it starts with section 3, so it's a little out of order as far as numerical, but it's in order of issues. This deals with procedures, both with APOC and the Ethics Committee. The process issues, to me, are a little bit different than just what is ethical. There was alignment of issues, for example, how many times do we have to report? What can the Ethics Committee do? What do you do if a member can't show up at a committee? It's really a process question issue. And I wanted to address them in context of process. And if you see where I've put something in that's out of its element, let me know. Some of them do kind of cross over a couple of the elements, both reporting and procedure. So, but this deals with many of the requests from the Ethics Committee on things that they saw that just didn't work well that are amended into this. This also will deal with some of the APOC and Ethics Committee communication. And then if you go to page 4, this deals primarily with enforcement issues, both with APOC and Ethics Committee. So one of the criteria that I brought up as we were going through this is, number one, what do legislators, legislative employees, and family members have to do that is, in fact, an ethical behavior? And what do we describe that once you cross that line is unethical? And then the same thing is true with Title 39, which is the public officials. And then how do we process that stuff, which was this that one section. Now we come to the enforcement. How do we actually do that? Some of it was issues that dealt with new authorities. For example, what do you do with the Office of Victims' Rights? Can you what can we enforce on them or not enforce on them? What about a legislative employee? And once again, how do you deal with APOC? So it fits slightly into the process, but it kind of leans toward the enforcement side. Once again, it deals with the Attorney General as a public officer, deputy heads of states, public officials, and AFOC reporting issues. So it's probably a little bit of process, a little bit of enforcement, but it fit more, in my mind, to enforcement issues. So the question that I've always asked on this is, do we have a growing authority, or do we have a more clearly defined authority? And I've kind of resisted the growing authority and have gravitated towards the more defined authority. And at least that's a criteria that I have in my mind and have continually brought up all along the way. Subcommittee members were persuaded by me to some degree, and I think the administration to some degree. But there is a need for certain enforcement issues. So with that, Mr. Chairman, what I have is, what I'd like to do is just kind of go through the sectional and describe each section so that we have it in context and where I see maybe some of the hotter issues coming up. And so it won't be an exact straight through the bill, but they will be in numerical order. Unless there's questions on that, I'll proceed.
Any questions? Representative Coghill, the floor is yours.
Just for what it's worth, Mr. Chairman, we have the folks from the Ethics Committee and AFOC here, and so I'm sure that if we have questions as to the meaning of something or what the effect of it is, I'm sure they'd be just more than happy to step forward. So,
ladies, because we're at the discretion of the chair, we have some latitude. Would you introduce yourself, just so you dedicate yourself to this function? We'd appreciate knowing who we're working with to help clarify the ethics law. Go ahead.
I'm Joyce Anderson, administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics.
Joyce.
I'm Brooke Miles, the executive director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission.
Hi, Brooke.
And attempted regulator of lobbying for the state.
I know that two out of three of you get calls routinely from probably every member of this committee. So it's a pleasure to have all three of you with us and available. And I would encourage you the same thing as Mr. Jones. If you see something that catches your eye, Joyce, you were with Jane earlier today and you had some thoughts. If we start to run into a ditch unintentionally, if you'll make eye contact with Representative Coghill or myself, we'd be delighted to stop the train and get our rails back on the track. So with that, it's a pleasure and honor to have you here. Representative Coghill.
The first two sections have to do with AFOC, so this is where Ms. Miles will have her ears tuned fairly well. The section one deals with the exception to reporting. The way the law stands now, that if you don't plan on spending $5,000 beyond $5,000 for a campaign, you're not required to report. That's been changed under this. It just says that if you're a delegate to a constitutional convention, a judge seeking electoral confirmation, or municipal office, that you don't have to report, but now all others will be required to report. So that changes the exemption rule for all candidates. And then section two is a deadline for mandatory electronic filing that puts a May 1, 2009 date in. And I think it's all candidates except for municipal office that warrant that live under this exemption, I think. So the debate that we had in committee, just to give you my idea, and certainly, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask for some memory jogging from both the chairman of State Affairs and Representative Gruenberg, who worked all the way through the subcommittee on this, but this debate is around, should we have mandatory reporting? The governor has been very persuasive in that we should have mandatory reporting, and so we find it in committee here with a kind of a stepped-in approach. This is the first step of that approach. Guys like me argued that it should be just the statewide offices, and I have been voted down So it might be something I might bring up. Who knows? Section 5.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Are you going to entertain any questions as we go along at this point?
I think it would be constructive.
Yes.
To stop Representative Coghill and to feel comfortable to direct your questions.
Especially considering my want to editorialize, right?
Yes. So I would encourage you as we proceed through the sections to pose a question to Representative Coghill, who is driving the narrative, to Mr. Jones, if it's appropriate, or to feel free to pose a question to Brooke or Joyce with Ethics or APOC. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As many times as I've gone through this, just having a break of a couple of weeks and looking at it again may cause me occasionally to ask a question, and I do have a question, and I think it's to Ms. Miles. And I don't know if you want to have them come up as a
I think we
panel
should have
to the hot seat.
Yeah, I think a couple of a chair, and we'll just rotate members up there as and I would hope that watching the clock, that what we can do is to really move through the bill today so that we all have a feel for the overall architecture, and then between public testimony, committee discussion, and opportunity for amendments, and then looking at the work product that we create, that is loosely the way that we're going to proceed through the week. So I would encourage members to ask questions as they see fit, but to bear in mind that it's a 41 section bill. But
this will be really brief.
On that point, I don't want us to get bogged down in the details and debate at this point.
Correct.
No. Correct. Ms. Miles, through the chair, on line 11, municipal office under 1513010, and Mr. Jones, too. Have we caught everybody in that net, like REAA candidates and people like that? Is there any technical group that we've maybe omitted?
Is this page 2, Representative?
No, I'm on page 1.
Page 1, line 11.
Page 1, line 11.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair. First, for the record, my name's Brooke Miles. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. I believe that municipal office under AS 1513010 will cover it, but I would bring to the chair and committee's attention that on the next page, beginning the municipal official, what we've done here under Alaska Statute 1513 is to put the definition of a municipal official under AS 3950. In other words, planning commissioners file financial disclosure reports, but they don't file campaign disclosure reports. Utility board members don't file campaign disclosure reports. They're not currently subject to the campaign disclosure law. Neither are REAAs.
I just want to be sure we haven't missed anybody.
We haven't missed anyone who's currently a filer.
Right. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a housekeeping question to follow up. Are we going to have the pleasure of these ladies' company in the coming days? I appreciate your desire to get through the entire bill today, but if we have questions, can we hold them?
Joyce, you're here for the week. Brooke, are you also here for the week? You're also here for the week? You're always
always.
Yes.
Thank you.
And Mr. Jones, you're with us for the week as well?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
So am I.
Can I get anybody anything? Okay, Representative Coghill, back to
sections 1 and 2. And if you want to, Mr. Chairman, you can turn back to page 3 while we have Ms. Miles sitting in front of us.
Page sections, 3 is the colored.
Yeah, and sections 3 and 4 of the bill are brought out here. They're process issues, but it would be worthy of note at this point since we have Ms. Miles here. The representative from Sand Lake and I have been working on a training course, and so this one would require APOC to administer an annually updated training course for lobbyists, employees of lobbyists, and then section 4 would require them to obtain a sworn affidavit or an affirmation that they completed the training course within a 12-month period. So those are two issues that APOC will have to look at. And so Without any, if there's not any questions further, then.
Representative Dahlstrom?
Just a quick one. So, Ms. Miles, did I interpret that we have a little bit of a discrepancy in that we're asking certain people to follow part of the rules, but not, I say rules. We're asking certain people to fill out some forms, but not all the forms, and then other people to fill out all the forms?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, I think my concern with the language on page 2 is that we're requiring information to be submitted electronically under AS 1513, and it exempts these municipal officials, which actually was negotiated between people because of the costs of all of the people who file municipal exemptions. But enlisting these people, there are people who don't campaign for office at all, are required to file financial disclosure statements, some of them, but they don't campaign, like planning and zoning.
And so may I have a question to the questioner?
Yes.
So my guess is this is an area that you might want to bring up for possible amendment then?
Yes.
Very good.
And that's what I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, yes, that as we go down through this, okay, there are going to be several areas that we will probably want to discuss at length.
Okay.
And this may be one of them, so just for my staff who's listening in over there. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Cargo?
Going back to page 1 of our sectional, and I have the bill on my left hand and my sectional on my right hand. Section number 5 is where we're at now, Mr. Chairman, which is page 4 of the bill. Section 5 puts a new prohibition on lobbyists, on campaign contributions or gifts that would violate Title 3952 of the executive ethics. And it's a bright line that we discussed within subcommittee, and there will be some debate.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Just as a matter of courtesy, we've been joined by Representative Gardner, who has an interest in this. And could she be a...
No, she may not. No members other than those on the House Judiciary Committee will be at the table. But you're welcome in the committee, and we thank you for attending. But we're going to limit this to just House Judiciary members.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you. And Representative Coghill, if we could put as a matter of discussion later, I have a concern if we're talking about overall ethics. I'm wondering if we need to amend the law that governs lobbyist gifts during the interim. I mean, if we're talking about just during session and we're talking about transparency, unless it's in the bill and I missed it. It's just
Mr. Chairman, just for what it's worth on this one, there's a whole list of what a lobbyist may not do here under this section.
Right.
Those primarily apply to legislators. Section 10 of this that is being amended says may not make or offer a gift or campaign contribution whose acceptance by a person may be affected under 24. So we're ruling on what the exemptions are to that. But under 3952, the reference is for lobbyists so that they'll know there is a direct prohibition. If they'll go over to the statute 39, mm-hmm, there's a further prohibition for those in the administrative branch of government.
Okay.
So we have a description of what may be done under Title 24, that is to legislators, because there is some exemptions and some very clear direction, but under Title 39, it's a further prohibition than what you would have for legislators. So it's just it's referencing it. Since lobbyists are going to be reading this rule, it puts them
right
over to the executive ethics portion. So
right.
I think I got that one.
And the statute that I was looking at was 24.60.080, and so we can just compare that later.
Right.
So thank you.
But that is one of the issues of where when you're crossing over between legislative and executive ethics on reporting procedures, that's one of the reasons why I did the color coding, because I quite often got caught in that quagmire.
Right. Thank you.
So that brings us to Section 6, which is a new subsection that allows a person... prohibits from lobbying because of a family relationship with a legislator, but it allows them to do representational lobbyists. And For what it's worth, that is in the tab 3 definitions if you want to find out what a representational lobbyist is. But they must register, but it's not required to pay the fee. So we've, and that was brought to our attention that the representational lobbyist is a creature of regulation, if I remember correctly. So. Section 7. Section 7 modifies language in the applicability section of legislative ethics that has time been interpreted various different ways as exempting legislators, legislative directors, employees, and public members of the committee from disclosure requirements. So Section 7 just puts them clearly under the authority of this chapter. And I think that that's a clarity thing that was brought to us by the Ethics Committee. So Section 8. I'm going to skip over Section 8. I'm going to go to Section 9. And the reason I'm going to skip over Section 8, I think that deals with page 4, unless you want to do it just section by section, Mr. Chairman.
I think a linear approach like that is helpful.
Well, then turn to page 4 of the sectional. This goes under enforcement statutes for APOC and ethics. In Section 8 prohibits a legislator from sending a constituent letter within 30 days of an election, which I thought was a good move. It's easy for us as incumbents to send a letter that could fall dangerously close to a campaign season. So this is a very clear line. So I don't know how many will end up on the day before the 30th, but I'm sure the post office will be able to tell us sometime soon.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
In all the time I've looked at this Section 8, I didn't consider something that should have been obvious, and that is whether a prohibition like this should also apply to somebody running for governor and or somebody running for a municipal office.
Lieutenant Governor.
Yeah, sure.
So that's a notation you make for when we begin to take up amendments?
Whenever we make the bill, yeah.
Representative Coghill?
And that's something Mr. Jones might want to look at. This is Title 24 dealing primarily with legislators, but point well taken. Section 9, then.
By the way, I'm sorry to interrupt one more time through the chair. The provision, and it's not apparent on the face of it, but Section 6, I believe, which deals with relatives, and that was a former Section 5 of the bill. There are some problems with that as to constitutionally how far we can reach in our authority. And Congress is in the process of considering a solution to that. And at the appropriate time, I'll probably offer an amendment which will flip it around and make it so it's clearly within our jurisdiction. Very I just good. Wanted to flag that to the folks. Okay.
Section 9, then, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Requires legislator or legislative employee to report board memberships to the Ethics Committee. And the question has been, what boards? And the answer has been, at this point, all boards.
So the board of your condominium, the board of your church or your synagogue, any board that you serve on in any capacity. Same question?
Yes.
Okay.
That was hotly debated.
And I think worthy of more debate.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Section 10, if you'll go back to page 3 of your sectional, Section 10 is under procedures of APOC and ethics. This streamlines ethic committee reporting processes for disclosures related to loans or programs participated in by legislators or employees of legislators. The change within 3 weeks to the next regularly scheduled report also allows the staff, upon request, to edit information at a, oh, I'm sorry. So it changes the timing of the reporting, and then it also allows for a to edit information, gives them some authority if there's an unjustifiable invasion of privacy. So I think, once again, this was a procedural point brought to us by the Ethics Committee on helping us kind of straighten up timeline issues and then how to protect people. In fact, there's a couple other amendments that we had in here that brought up the idea of how do you protect people when reporting very sensitive information. So Section 10 is also on that page 3 of our sectional, and that Section 10 deals with the Ethics Committee reporting process. It streamlines it. Once again, I'm on Section 11. I'm sorry. Skip over. We're back on page 1 again. Section 11.
Chairman.
Representative Samuels.
I had a question on Section 10 for Representative Coghill.
Yes, sir.
Regarding loans, if you are the sole shareholder of a corporation or an LLC, and my LLC got AIDA money or AHFC money or something along those lines, do I have to report that I'm the shareholder of the Samuels Real Estate Company under one part of the APOC forms, but do I have to report the loans for that company, the financing for my company and that LLC, or do you just say I'm the sole shareholder of the Samuels Real Estate Venture, it's a corporation, it is not an LLC, and I have a loan from ADA?
The answer to that question, because I'm in that unique situation,
is
you do both, because you have a personal guarantee and you have a corporate guarantee. So in different parts of the form, you answer in the affirmative to both of those. In the present, I believe it's right. Yes, ma'am?
Sure.
Thank heavens.
And I think
we did not change that.
No, we're not.
Thank you.
And we will talk about other reporting requirements along the way. This primarily was changing how do you protect certain private information and then what is a reporting process. So we tried to get the reporting process within 30 days of the event or on a regularly scheduled reporting.
But Mr. Chairman, the real crux of the question came to, if it's proprietary information dealing with the finances of a business person, it is going to be protected, or do you have to go before the Ethics Committee or before APOC? You have to explain your finances to somebody or do you say, I have a loan from ADA?
Mr. Chairman, the language in here says that it would be by a determination of the committee. It would be the quorum, first of all, and then the committee. The Ethics Committee would determine if it was unjustifiable privacy invasion.
Thank you.
And at this point, it does require you to state the gross amount of the loan as well as the term of the loan. And I believe the interest rate also is presently required under disclosure, current disclosure rules.
Yes,
Joyce, coming up.
A question, I guess, for you, Mr. Chairman, because is that public information then? The term of the loan, everything, is it public from ADA's point of view or HFC's point of view? And also, if you're disclosing it, is it considered confidential? I'm just making sure the people that have business interests around the state can still run for office here without disclosing everything
the
public that's out of a competitive nature. Your financing of a company is a competitive situation.
In its current form, you correct me if I'm wrong, in its current form, because I'm the recipient of an ADA loan, and this is the second one that I've done. The last one was in 1993. It requires me to disclose the portion of the loan that is with ADA. I have to disclose the initial amount, the amount that is currently owned, the length of the term, the amortized amount. It does not require me to disclose the portion that is with my primary lending institution, only to indicate that I have a relationship with the primary lender. But ADA's paperwork is generally available for the public, to the public anyway, because it's a public process. So I believe that loan documentation would be available if you were to go approach ADA and ask for a history of the loans that they have outstanding, that's that those are public documents, and that's the choice that somebody in the private sector makes when they choose to do business with a state entity. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thank you.
That was Brooke Miles from APOC. Joyce, do you have anything to add?
Yes, I'd like to, Mr. Chair, if I could, Representative Samuels, through the chair. This is actually under the ethics part. What your question was more for APOC, but under this particular section here, or in the ethics statute, we do have where certain loans have to be reported. And as Representative Ramirez said, an ADA loan does need to be reported, and it does require just the name of the loan, the dollar amount, and the term. So actually, there's two types of reporting, one through the financial disclosure and then one also through ethics. And only certain state benefit and loan programs need to be reported, and there's certain criteria that are followed. And the criteria is if it's a discretionary award, if there's not any fixed criteria for awarding that, then it is disclosed to the Ethics Committee as well as to APOC. So we're looking at really two different things for the same question, if that makes sense.
Thank you. And just for Representative Coghill's benefit, I'm going to ask the same question about the proprietary and making sure the people that operate businesses in this state do not get so boxed in by this piece of legislation that they can't run for office and they just throw up their hands and go to heck with it.
And along those lines, and I've talked to Representative Newman, so I'm not in any way casting aspersions on him, but I'm going to, as we proceed through this, reference the Newman rule, because there are a lot of rules that would apply to members who have precisely those concerns, and we have had extensive conversations with Representative Newman, Representative Grunberg. We've set in, and Newman, it just seems to apply to many, many, many of us. And in fact, we had a conversation out in the hall just at noon today on precisely this subject. So when we start talking about the Newman rule, I think it's applicable to many, many, many members. So I appreciate your concern. Encourage you to speak on behalf of all those that are contemplating running for public office, because we're strengthened as a citizen legislature when those of us leave our primary vocations to, you know, strengthen the state of Alaska. So thank you very much for that, Representative Samuels. Representative Grunberg?
Just one word that really we hadn't talked about through the chair to Ms. Anderson. Page 9, line 27. We normally don't say, and a quorum of a committee determines. The word quorum, you would normally say a majority of the sitting members or a majority of those present. What do you mean by the word quorum, through the chair?
Isn't that 12?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair.
That's 12.
That is language that was drafted by legal, so I would, when I look at the word quorum, I would assume that a quorum would mean, that's a good question, a majority of the committee. Maybe we need to change that language.
Yeah,
to make it more specific.
Norm, if you'd look at that, because that's kind of an unusual.
It is an unusual term. Thank you, Representative Grunberg. Representative Coghill?
Okay, that brings us to Section 11. Section 11 eliminates legislator from close economic association with lobbyists in reporting to the ethics, because we are taking legislators, putting them in a position where they can no longer have a close economic relationship with lobbyists. So it's a cleanup language. I just noticed that I misspoke. So maybe we should have some clarification on that. I just saw. Well, Mr. Jones may be able to clarify this for us.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the intent of this section was to conform the language to an amendment that fell out inadvertently because of some duplicated uses of designations. So there was to be an amendment in this bill that would prohibit legislators, spouses, and domestic partners from serving as lobbyists. That fell out because there was an overlapping in the subsection designations. And so this really was just conforming language.
Mr. Chair.
And I understood that was conforming language. I must confess the language falling out. I remember the discussion, but I forgot about it.
Mr. Chair, what happened was there was a technical glitch in the drafting. It was not the committee's intent that that language fall out, but in fact it did. And when I talked a minute ago about a constitutional problem, that section six or whatever wasn't the right, that wasn't, I was referring to the missing section.
Okay.
I'll offer an amendment at the appropriate time, and we'll make sure, we all have to make sure that section 11 conforms to that.
Okay, very good.
We've talked a lot about that.
And the question falls around, should a legislator's spouse be able to lobby? And the general consensus was no, it's just that this was conforming language, this was not the actual language.
And through the chair, the problem that we're trying to confront is whether we have jurisdiction over spouses, relatives, everybody else. And there may be problems in prohibiting them, but we can prohibit the member and the member's employees from dealing with them. And they've got a change in the U.S. Senate rule
okay.
that is being contained in a bill that's going through the House now, and we're going to use that as a model.
Thank you. Representative Coghill.
Section 12 deals with adds the Office of Victims' Rights to the list of legislative employees that do not qualify for discounts. They're given to legislators and to their staff to make the stay session affordable, but not for Office of Victims' Rights.
Okay.
So Section 13 adds gifts received by family members of legislators and legislative employees to disclosures that are maintained for public record and forwarded then to APOC. This is part of the communication between Ethics and APOC.
Representative Coghill, Joyce.
Representative Ramos, I'd like to point out that in this particular section on line 19, we still have a March, an annual disclosure on or before March 15th, and we made changes in the rest of the statutes and forgot this one.
Okay, and that so reference an then amendment. Should be what date?
Line 19, it should say, shall disclose to the committee within 30 days of receipt of the gift.
It was 30 days of the event is how we normally have been.
And this actually is a gift in this right, section, so we could use the word gift. But I just wanted to point out we missed that particular section.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Joyce.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I would request that Ms. Anderson work with somebody here, Ms. Pearson, to deal with that.
Yes. Representative Samuels.
Thank you. I have a question for Representative Coghill. In your Section 3 of your definitions here, immediate family has a definition. Immediate family member it appears has a little bit different definition. Mm-hmm. Mostly dealing with parents and siblings. The first one I read at the top of page 5 says if your parents live with you or your sibling lives with you and they're dependent on you, they are an immediate family member. And the second one, I guess I'd need to read that additional site, but
if I may, Mr.
speaking
Chairman,
for myself, I have no idea where my dad makes his money. I have no clue.
Mr. Jones.
The two different definitions apply to two different titles in the statutes. The first, immediate family, applies in Title 24. The second applies only to the executive branch under the Executive Branch Ethics Act, and that is a broader definition of immediate family member.
Took the words right out of my mouth.
Joyce? May I say I'm real pleased with this format to have you come up and interject. So it's helpful to me. So don't hesitate when you've got something you're doing just right.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, there are really two definitions of immediate family in the ethics code. There is a different definition under the gift section, and then there's a definition that covers the rest of the ethics code. So really, we have two definitions. The executive branch has a definition as well. So in this section that you're referring to right now is the gift section, Section 13, so that has a different definition of immediate family versus the rest of the ethics code, such as, for instance, your question before about loans and so forth. So that doesn't apply. This goes, the immediate family in the gift section is really broader. I do not see that definition in your definitions, Representative Cochran.
It's on page 4 at the bottom of my definition section. There's a section immediate family member under 2445-171, and then the one under 2469-90.
Well, there's also a definition of immediate family in 2460-080.
080.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the one that deals with just the gift section. That's what I wanted to point out.
Okay.
So there's definitely a third definition.
That's the one I brought up earlier.
So
we don't really know what a family member is.
And that's my point. As I said, I'm going to use myself as an example in all the questions to go through here, and I haven't lived and breathed this like some of you have, but my father works contracting for a company, but do I have to go ask him things now? I mean, he's an immediate family member. He's not dependent on me in the slightest bit. I'm not in the executive branch, but if it comes to gifts, do I have to learn three separate codes here for a family member that I have? That's for the legislator. And what am I going to have to do? I'm confused sitting here right now, much less when I'm filling out forms and I don't have you sitting there to ask.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, you as a legislator do not have to worry about the executive branch definition of family. You have two definitions, not three. The definition of family, which relates to state benefit and loan programs and so forth, you would not need to worry about that definition unless you were dependent on that family member. So in other words, you're financially dependent on that family member, your father. You live with your father. You share expenses. You have a house together. You have a car together. Those would be the requirements for knowing whether that family member has a state benefit or loan program through the state. When it comes to the definition of immediate family for the gift section, which only applies to the gift section, it does go into, you know, the grandparent, the aunt, the uncle of yourself and a spouse and so forth. So, yes, it does definitely go into other areas.
So, Joyce, if someone had a situation where there was a family trust set up and every member of, you know, the family contributed in some way, shape, or form, and maybe it went to an educational fund for all grandkids or whatever, then we would need to know that information that Representative Samuel's talking about, because everyone in the family contributed to that.
Well, that's not really a gift. That would not fall under the definition of gift under the gift section.
It would.
So you would not need to.
Down the road, it wouldn't be a gift to our children or grandchildren?
It would be a gift. But let me think how I want to word this. Give me just one second.
Mr. Chair, I may be able to help.
Yes, Representative Brumberg.
Did the members bring their Title 24 with them, the blue book? If you grab your Title 24, it's AS 24.60.080.
That's correct.
And the two places, and if you'd look, the definition is in subsection K. And Joyce, please correct me if I'm wrong on this through the chair. Immediate family or family member means a spouse, number two, the person's domestic partner, three, a child, including a stepchild and an adopted child of the person or the person's domestic partner, four, a parent, sibling, grandparent, aunt, or uncle of the person, five, a parent, sibling, grandparent, aunt or uncle of the person's spouse or the person's domestic partner, and six, a step-parent, step-sister, step-brother, step-grandparent, step-aunt or step-uncle of the person's spouse or the person's domestic partner. And I can see that used in two places in that statute. One, Mr. Chair, and again, Joyce, please correct me if I'm wrong, is in subsection C, which says, notwithstanding A of the section, which says you can't get a gift, it is not a violation of this section for a legislator or a legislative employee to accept gift and sub 5 gifts from the immediate family of the person. So that means if you got a gift from your step aunt, you're okay. The other one, which is what Representative Samuels is talking about, is in sub I, and I'm going to read that, if I may. A legislator or legislative employee who knows or reasonably should know that a family member has received a gift because of the family member's connection with the legislator or legislative employees shall report the receipt of the gift by the family member
to the committee if the gift would have to be reported under this section if it had been received by the legislator or legislative employee, or if the receipt of the gift by a legislator or legislative employee would be prohibited under this section. And I think that's what Representative Samuels was referring to. Am I correct in what I'm citing there?
If I could, Mr. Chairman, my point of asking the question is that when somebody chooses to run for office, they're not going to have Title 24 in front of them. And I would bet if we walked into any office in this building right now and asked if they knew these rules, even the current rules, the harder you make it, the more difficult it is to comply. And now, as I'm sitting here, I just noticed that the same words had two different definitions depending. I understand, but 2 days from now, I probably couldn't explain it back again. And that, my problem, and we can move on, but the way that it is right now, I'm trying to make it somewhat reasonable for people to run for office and serve without having to get worried about it getting nicked.
With all due respect, Representative Samuels, my colleague to my left, who's in his ninth year in the legislature, still has to call Ledge Ethics and APOC for clarification, I assume, from time to time. So I don't know that we would ever succeed in distilling it down to being a simple enough document that any of us, even the most experienced, Representative Grunberg, I'm sure, has occasion to call APOC and Ethics, and he's been in and out of the legislature since the 80s. So I don't know that
I understand
that what you want can be achieved regardless of what we do.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kaka,
when it comes to definitions, those are awkward, except for probably need tighter definitions for some things than others. And so when it's about gifts, you need a broader definition, as I understand what the Ethics Committee is talking about, where you can be much more narrow when it comes to other issues of reporting. So
point taken.
Okay.
But
Mr. We can move on.
Okay.
I shouldn't have brought it up.
Remember,
I am concerned about, this is something we didn't discuss at all. In a family situation, if the grandparents set up a trust and the trust goes to the grandchildren and the child, the intermediate person's in the legislature, that would appear to mean that the grandchild has to report to the committee the trust annual gifts, the $11,000-$12,000 that the grandparents give under the trust, or UTMA, Uniform Transfers to Minors Act, every year, because they're getting it because their parents in the, you know, their parent is the parent who happens to be in the legislature. Is that being done now?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, basically the gift needs to be received, the person receiving the gift needs to receive the gift based on your legislative status. If I have had phone calls regarding trusts, and my advice to the individual calling was no, it does not need to be reported because it's not based on a legislative status. It's based on a family relationship that you're giving that person the money, in the trust. So I don't look at that as being a problem.
Very good. Thank you, Joyce. Please continue, Representative Cargill.
Section 15 is a new section, and if you want to see the it's on page 4 of the sectional under enforcement issues. This prohibits serving legislators from directly or by authorizing others on their behalf to accept compensation. So this is a new law saying if you're a legislator, you cannot act or have your legislative aides act on behalf or accept money or compensation for work that you get paid for as a legislator. So it seemed reasonable to us, that section 15. Section 16 also is under the enforcement portion, prohibits a legislator or their employee from being compensated before a municipal, legislative, or executive entity. So it even goes a little further in that definition. So,
Mr. Chair, that section 16 was the subject of some discussion.
Yes.
Which I'll discuss some more.
And probably not done with that.
Okay.
Discussion. Section 17 streamlines reporting requirements so that unless otherwise provided, disclosure deadlines for legislators, employees, and committee members of the Ethics Committee will be 30 days after the matter of interest. And that's what I was quoting before.
Okay.
And under the gift, it would be 30 days after the gift if we make that amendment. Section 18 is a new law that requires a former legislator, legislative employee, or public member of the Select Committee on Ethics to file a disclosure for all matters relevant to that when that person was a legislator, employee, or a public member of the Select Committee on Ethics, even though they no longer hold the position. And Section 18, I think, is within 90 days.
All right, and I would direct members to lines 29 and 30 of Section 18, which needs some language cleanup. It says subject to disclosure under this chapter while the person was serving, which Jane and I thought may reach back to cover your entire tenure in the legislature, which is a long period of time for some members here. So that probably will require some cleanup language.
So Section 19 is on page 3 of your sectional under procedures and processes of the APOC and Ethics Committee. This allows the chairman, chairperson of the Ethics Committee or a subcommittee to designate an alternate legislative member to attend meetings if the regular member is unable. And then, so currently the chair can only appoint an alternate if the regular member has a conflict. So this gives a little broader authority to the Ethics Committee, but it probably is a good process. Section 20 also is process issue, allows the chairman some authority, or the subcommittee chairman, to designate an alternate member to attend a meeting if the regular member is excused under a violation of a complaint and disqualified. And it goes through a series of how you get to that member if you have a presiding officer, for example, that's under that ethics charge. So Section 21 also is about the duties of the Ethics Committee, requiring it publish certain educational ethics material at January of this year, and of course administer the course that had been put into this bill. So Section 21 is about the education portion.
Joyce? Excuse me, Representative Cockfield, Joyce?
Representative Ramirez, what I'd like to point out is that Section 21 on line 17 talks about in January of each year and at other times determined by the committee administer a legislative ethics course. And then when you go down to Section 22 on line 25, it talks about only conducting an ethics course the first day of the first regular session. So I think we need to clarify that as to, I think the intent of the Ethics Committee and the House State Affairs was to have it each year. So we may want to change that language on line 26. Or excuse me, 25.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. This is an idea that percolated with a member from Sand Lake, and I agreed with.
That's from Sand Lake.
You're not Sand. Are you? Aren't you from Sand Lake?
That's Bob. No.
I've said that twice now. Mountain View. I'm sorry.
I thought you were talking about Ralph.
That's Bob.
No, the. I'm sorry. I've been giving you.
Bob Book is from Sand Lake.
Yeah, Bob Book.
I'm sorry. The this member over here, Mr. Grunberg, and I hooked up this idea. So I'm glad to fix it, but I'll give you the intent was to have, of course, because of the dynamics of reporting procedures, both with lobbyists and legislators, that we have put together a disc that would allow an affidavit to be signed off on. Mm-hmm. And it's there in my mind, if this grows into a full day course like we had at the beginning of this session, the answer is no. Because I think that it was valuable for us as the issue came up, but to make that a annual occurrence, mm-hmm. I think would be not only wearisome but almost a mockery to the what we have to do. So,
Mr. Chair, please, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment here that, given the discussions about the 90-day session and how when the session may or may not be proceeding, we might want to consider an amendment instead of in January that is more similar to the language in Section 22, saying within a certain number of days at the start of the session, and the idea that the session may or may not actually be starting in January in future years.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Representative Grunberg.
Yes, and I think this should be really clear on the record to Ms. Anderson through the chair. When we talked about administering the course, we intended that would be administered, you would have the course at the beginning of the legislature and then administer it by a disk that they could just take home and view. That is what we meant. So.
Okay. Representative Coghill?
Mr. Speaker, with that, we're almost halfway through the bill. I mean, Mr. Chairman, we're almost halfway through. The Sand Lake thing rattled me.
You look very nice today, Mr. Coghill.
Thank you. Section 23 is an addition of authority. It's on page 4 of my sectional. This section adds the ability for APOC and the Ethics Committee to request an advisory opinion under our statutes 2460-160. It adds the requirements the advisory opinion be redacted before publication to protect the identity of persons involved, and makes the vote record of the committee a public record. So those are new things on Section 23. Section 24 is one of the questions that's come up about our Ethics Committee on legal advice to the Ethics Committee. Allows a person who have provided legal advice to the Ethics Committee in the past but no longer do so to be appointed by the committee to present the case against the person charged. We've had, and maybe Joyce could explain part of the argument, but it's been the person who brings a charge also kind of sits as the arbiter or the judge, legal judge, and I think we're trying to solve that problem. And maybe Joyce could speak to that.
Joyce, and then Representative Samuels has a question.
Representative Ramirez and the committee. What's happened in the past is that the Ethics Committee hires outside legal counsel. That outside legal counsel provides legal counsel to myself and to the Ethics Committee. And this language, or we're changing actual language that was put in a couple of years ago that would prohibit the person that provides legal counsel to myself and the Ethics Committee from actually presenting a case when there is a complaint. And otherwise, there would be a conflict of interest. What this does is if there's someone in the past that has presented, or excuse me, provided legal counsel to the Ethics Committee and they no longer do, they would be have the option to present the case regarding the complaint.
And it also, Mr. Chairman, this particular section allows the changing the date of a hearing. At this point, I think they have a, 90-day limit?
That's correct.
And it allows the committee to dismiss a complaint if the delay caused by the complaint and the cost is not supported by compelling reasons. So this gives them a, I think beyond the 90-day, and without reading the whole bill, I think, is it up to 6 months? I can't remember. It was beyond the 90 days. Isn't that true?
Yes.
So that's an open-ended beyond the 90 days?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And I remember part of the discussion, I think we were, at one point we had talked about a 6-month, 90 days, 6 months, I can't remember.
It was open-ended.
It was always open-ended? Okay.
Well, I mean, it is now.
Okay, that brings us to Section 25.
Hi.
Representative Samuels.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Actually, thank you, Madam Chair. On back to 23, the advisory opinions. If I could ask Representative Coghill, what was the debate surrounding that? Was there a discussion of gamesmanship that can go on with the advisory opinions?
I think what happened.
I asked for 10 advisory opinions, nothing to do with me. Do I ask advisory opinions about myself and my situation? I own this company. I have this stock. It's kind of up in the air. I was business partners with so and so. Or can I ask for advisory opinions about my colleague to my right? This situation exists, and I just throw out 10 different situations with no names attached to them until I get the answer I want, and away you go, and that's the public, and then it becomes all public. And do you see?
I see what you mean.
I got like a comment from somebody who actually has to deal with. Do you get a lot of requests for them, or I could just see the gamesmanship.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, when you request an advisory opinion, it has to be on an action that you are contemplating, not someone else.
Okay.
The Ethics Committee would not look at it if you were requesting it based on someone else's circumstances. And basically, we have advisory opinions going back into the 80s, and they're a lot of this, the language on lines 12 through 17 is basically common practice, what's been done, but it was unclear in the statute, so we asked for some clarification language, so there's really no change to present practice.
Okay, thank you. That answers my question.
And I appreciate the question, because what we're trying to do is allow what is an ethical question to be brought forward, not to have the committee used in unethical manners.
I understand. I got the answer that I was looking for, so I'm happy. I don't need any further explanation.
So section 25 is on page 4 under enforcement of my sectional, and this defines the victim's advocate as the appointing authority for the purpose of determining how to sanction an employee of the Office of Victims' Rights. So this is cleanup language, actually, I think, brought to us by the Ethics Committee. And then because of that, you have to say, well, what about the Office of Victims' Rights? And so the legislator becomes the appointing authority to the Office of Victims' Rights. So it's a clarification of the authority line.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
The term, quote, victim's advocate means a specific office holder. It's not a person who is a lawyer representing victims.
True. Yes, I'm sorry.
It's like ombudsman.
Thanks. Thank you. Representative Coghill.
Thank you for clarifying that. So that takes us to section 26, right?
Yep.
Financial disclosures. Section 26 is on
page two.
Sorry about that. We're back at page two. This section 26 talks. Oh yes, section 26. Yes. I remember this one now. This is 246200, which was in the vote that we took last November with regards to reporting requirements on the initiative that passed. And so this is amending the initiative, and I always like to bring that forward. But actually, we have the authority to do that. It's just that here we have it. Here we have the amendment. So this talks about what is required to disclose, clarifying the disclosure of income received for personal services or a loan guarantee to be reported to APOC in the annual financial disclosure under both Title 24 and 39. It requires that when a person's income is reported, the approximate number of hours worked must be reported along with any other information the earner wishes to report. And so this will be a subject of discussion. This is a little bit different than what's in, Senate Bill 19, I think. Is it Senate Bill 19? 20. Where this language is 20? Okay. So my guess is we'll be debating this one. We'll be looking at the original language in the initiative and what the proposed changes are. But my suggestion is this will be one that I certainly will debate, and I don't know about others.
And the word wishes to report is...
Well,
must report,
any
report,
and
shall
additional
report.
Information regarding how the income, and that's why I put wishes in mind, because, and additional information, well, that can be disputed.
Right.
So all that's right. Why I put that in there. So I think we still have some work to do on that.
Okay.
Okay, that takes us to section 27. It requires a person who is appointed after, section 27. This is, I know. When a person gets appointed to the legislature, you might know this, Madam Chair.
I will.
So when a person gets appointed to the legislature or a public member of the committee, or the legislative director must file a financial disclosure with APOC within 30 days of that appointment, which has not been required up to now. So that's what section 27 does. 28 deals with mandatory filing again, electronic filing, disclosures for legislators, directors, executive committee members by July 1, 2008, except in a case where APOC makes an exception, which was allowed for, and that language was, wasn't, I think that was Mr. Grunberg's language on, with the exception. And I think the date is in the back. Let me just take a quick gander there. Section 28, yeah. Section 42 says Section 28 of this Act takes effect July 1, 2008. So that's part of the staggered approach that the administration brought before us. And so that's mandatory electronic reporting. Same for my own emphasis. Section 29 is in on page 4 of the sectional. Specifies that when APOC finds a person at the Office of Victims' Rights has failed to refuse or refused, that APOC will be notified, Ledge Council will notify APOC. So I think Section 29 is a reporting issue. Section 30 on page 2, now we're dealing with Title 39. In fact, we've just crossed over. Just be aware, we just crossed over from Title 24 to Title 39. This is where Mr. Jones begins to speak. And if you wish, Madam Chair, I could have him go through it, or I can continue on in the vein that I've been doing.
Mr. Jones, what is your preference?
Whatever is your preference, Madam Chair.
Representative Samuels?
I think I've got one question before we do the switch there.
All right.
Joyce is a legislative employee, so are you yourself covered under
yes.
under these, and APOC, both the commissioners and the employees, executive branch employees?
The commission is required to file an annual financial disclosure statement. Employees of APOC are not, and we're all subject to AS 3952 executive branch.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
I want to make sure. Okay, thanks.
Mr. Jones, why don't you go ahead and give us an overview, and then if questions come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 30 deals with financial disclosure requirements for former public officials. It would just make clear that when someone who's required as an executive branch official to file a financial disclosure leaves office, that person must file a financial disclosure statement for that last period of service within 90 days of leaving state service. Section 31 deals with
Representative Grunberg.
The chair. What was the equivalent thing that we were 90 days? Where was that in Title 24, Representative Coghill? To the chair.
Oh my goodness.
Or somebody. We just dealt with that, and I just was trying to find it.
Section 18, I believe, Representative Grunberg, through the chair.
Reason. Okay, may I just say something?
Yes.
I'd like this very clear on the record. Section 18 and Section 30, because they use the term 90 days after the person's final day, that really is it doesn't start until the day after, so it's like 91 days, like the 121-day session, if you count the day. In other words, they don't count the day you leave office. They start counting the day after you leave, and I just like that clear on
that. Is that your interpretation, Mr. Jones?
Madam Chair,
I just want that clear.
I believe that that is correct. It's the 90th day after leaving office.
All right, thank you for that clarification. Please proceed.
Thank you. In Section 31, this would require additional information in the financial disclosures that members of the executive branch, some judicial officers, and some municipal officers would have to file with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. The administration asked that the reporting threshold be $1,000. The committee chose to keep it at the current level of $5,000. In addition, the committee chose to require reporting of hours only for income that is earned on an hourly basis. Section 32.
Oh, question on that? If it's on income earned on hourly basis, if I work on a contract, or the person is on a contract salary, not hourly, they don't need to disclose that?
That's correct, Madam Chair, under the language as it's currently.
Do you see an inconsistency with that?
Madam Chair, our proposal was to require reporting of hours for all income earned. The committee made a different policy choice.
All right, let's put that for a topic of discussion. All right, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 32 deals with additional requirements for blind trusts that public officials may establish to avoid conflicts of interest. And that would be administered by the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Section 33 requires electronic filing once again, this time for the financial disclosures that members of the executive branch in certain high-level positions, judicial officers, and certain municipal officers must file. Municipal officers, however, are exempted from this electronic filing requirement. In addition, folks who are subject to the requirement may request exemption, and the Alaska Public Offices Commission may grant such exemptions when the circumstances warrant it. This requirement would take effect as of July 1 of this year, 2007.
And the reason that municipal officers were exempted is?
Madam Chair, the committee's policy choice with which the administration agrees is that we can make some steps toward mandatory electronic filing that'll be more effective if we cover the folks that are best able to comply. And our concern was that in many of the smaller villages and towns across the state, electronic filing isn't a realistic option. And rather than making it mandatory and then allowing all sorts of exceptions, we would just take a staggered approach to implementation by at least as of now exempting municipal officers.
All right, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
One of the questions that we're going to have to ask, and I'm just going to put it out now for Mr. Jones on the blind trust issue. This was incorporating an issue that Representative Seaton had brought to us. It's a tool, and I'm going to be asking a couple of questions on the appropriateness of it, the ability to use it, what areas would most likely be used in, and then the language of it, if we're actually in fact blind in this trust.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, just so the record is clear, there is currently this statute, 3950-040, on the books. It's been a while since it was updated, and this was an issue that Representative Seaton brought up for the first time in the last legislature, and has been working on it really for a year. And this proposed language was taken from the New Jersey statute, which he felt was the best statute in the country. We put it in state affairs, simply without any discussion, so that this issue could be looked at by the Judiciary Committee. And it is there simply as a new piece of legislation. And several of us have been in touch with some of the members of the trust bar to look at it. And it's a voluntary kind of a thing. And I am also looking at it, if it is adopted in the executive code, Executive Ethics Act, whether we should look at it as an option in the Legislative Ethics Act, too. So we could optionally do this. And potentially, I've talked to the folks in the judiciary to see if they want to have this in Title 22 as well.
Mr. Jones, if I could task you with looking into that a little bit more, and then you and Representative Coghill, as chair of the subcommittee, kind of working through that, and we'll bring that up again.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Okay, please proceed.
Representative Seaton needs to describe it. You know, he'll have to carry it.
Section 34 deals with what is a significant financial interest in a business, and this comes under the Executive Branch Ethics Act. A couple of lawyers several years ago examined an issue involving a former attorney general and pointed out that there was nothing in the Executive Branch Ethics Act that clearly established what a significant financial interest was for purposes of violations of that act. this provision is aimed at addressing that omission. Section 35 would establish a presumption that any gift from a lobbyist to a member of the executive branch or a member of the executive branch family member is prohibited unless the person receiving it is an immediate family member of the lobbyist giving the gift. Section 36 would affect a provision that exists under current law that restricts the employment activities of someone who leaves state service. That those restrictions apply for 2 years after leaving state service. Currently, there's an exception for any work that you've done during your state service on legislation or regulations. This provision would eliminate that exception so that even work on legislation and regulations would be subject to that 2 year set of restrictions.
Madam Chair,
Representative Cogdill.
Just as an example, if you worked on a regulatory package for environmental protection issues, then you might not be able to take a contract with somebody or go to work for a environmental firm for the next 2 years.
Representative Cockhill, through the chair, that's correct. If it is the same matter and you were personally and substantially involved in that matter, those are the two restrictions that exist under current law.
And Madam Chair, the discussion that we had in committee is we're a small state, we have small groups of people. We might be taking our brain trust and putting them in an awkward position. Notwithstanding, there are real issues for those who work within administration and find some high up positions in policy matters. So I don't know that we've found the perfect balance yet, but 2 years seem to be the best balance.
Right. And Mr. Jones, is personally and substantially involved defined? If I am on committee and I vote in committee, say the matter comes to the floor,
Madam Chair, this is dealing with the executive. So if you're,
I apologize.
If you're in a position where you've dealt with putting together regulations, I think that's the problem that would arise.
But those two words are defined.
Madam Chair, they're not defined. They're subject to interpretation by the Attorney General's Office and the Personnel Board, both of whom are charged with enforcement of the Executive Branch Ethics Act.
Do you see a need for definition?
There is currently a definition of personally and substantially in regulation, mm-hmm. But that doesn't define it for all circumstances. It does take some interpretation on case by case.
This would probably be a good time to ask Mr. Jones to describe to us the process of reporting what a designated reporter is and why the Attorney General is involved in this.
Please do.
I'd be happy to do that, Representative Cockhill, through the chair.
Please do. If
I have a question about whether what I'm going to do is a violation of the Ethics Act, I report that to my designated ethics supervisor. Each department has a designated ethics supervisor. By statute, it's established as the commissioner of the department in which I work. But as a practical matter, most of them delegate that authority to someone else, often a deputy commissioner or a special assistant. If that designated ethics supervisor knows the answer, he or she gives it. If that person needs some help, that person will consult the Attorney General's office and will provide advice.
Okay.
If the person acts in accordance with the advice and direction from the ethics supervisor, then they're home free. If they violate that advice, then they're subject to charges under the Ethics Act.
And is that advice given to them in writing?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Ordinarily, it's given in writing, although sometimes we give oral advice, but anytime somebody wants it in writing, either in a formal memorandum or by email, we give it to them.
Great. Thank you. Please proceed. Question, Representative Samuels.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yes, a question either for Representative Cockhill or the administration was it discussed going the other way if I had lobbied for an environmental firm for a regulation for a cruise ship or whatever regulation. If I was a lobbyist on the front end, is there an ethical problem going into government then? I mean, I can think of a couple people in this building right now that were lobbyists, went into an administration, and then went out and were lobbyists again. So is there a problem? Next administration comes in, they're going to leave lobbying and go into the administration. Is there a problem going that way at all? And I don't.
First of all, to my recollection, we didn't bring that issue up in the subcommittee. And I think you would have a practical barrier problem of the ability to hire people. So I would defer to other members, but I certainly don't recall that coming up as a serious point of discussion.
Or on that same line, someone who lobbied and then came into the legislative branch.
Yeah.
With.
And if I may, Madam Chair. Elected, I'm sorry.
Right. They were elected.
They're elected. That's a little different.
If I may, Madam Chair. Under the Executive Branch Ethics Act, we would focus on whether that person still has any personal or financial interest, as those terms are defined in the Executive Branch Ethics Act. As Representative Coghill mentioned, we'd have some recruitment problems in a state of this size if we were to refuse to hire those who have expertise in the area but want to leave the private sector to serve the state. So the line we draw is that they may not act on matters in which they have significant personal or financial interests while they're in state service.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you. I agree. It'd be tough to do that. But by putting the 2 years in, if you are a lobbyist or you're lobbying for whatever, if you've got 2 years looking at the other end of it, do you think you're going to have the same problem with recruiting people with expertise to come into the process, if they're going to look and say, well, my shelf life, if I'm liked, is 4 years. If I'm not liked, it could be a month. And then 2 years after that, I can't go back to my original profession that I'm an expert in. So are you going to get less people coming into the system by putting the two-year barrier on there? Do you see a problem with recruitment? It's a small pool of people to understand how government works. And so was that discussed by the administration or at the previous committee?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, it certainly was a consideration, I assume, when this provision was originally enacted back in 1986. It's something that we've had on the books since that time. This amendment would only eliminate that exception for work on legislation and regulations. Okay. My understanding is the reason that exception was in there was that the Department of Law was very concerned about being able to attract attorneys with expertise in oil and gas matters if they were going to be prohibited from taking higher paying jobs in the private sector for 2 years after leaving state service.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Grunberg, thank you. And I want to recognize that our friend, the member from Sand Lake, is here.
Yes.
did you hear the rest of the discussion?
Representative Book is here.
The real representative from Sand Lake.
The real representative from Sand Lake.
They were accusing me of representing Sand Lake.
Representative Grunberg, go ahead.
The question that Representative Samuels has stated is something that has occurred to me, and it's something that goes beyond this. Under the rules of the legislature, if we have a conflict of interest, all we have to do is enunciate it, and it takes unanimous consent to stop us from voting. And even if we walk off the floor, they can call the House or the committee or whatever. I don't know if they can call it. I mean, that's never been fully decided, but certainly can call the House. And there is a certain inconsistency. And I think that is probably true in most legislatures, the feeling being that we don't just represent ourselves, we represent our constituencies in the state. But there is an intellectual issue there, I think.
Well said. Just Mr. Coghill.
Just for what it's worth, probably the difference is getting an elected position where you represent several thousand people over against an individual decision that may very well be personal gain. So I think that's probably the big difference.
Mr. Chair, if I may continue, I was just about to pick up with Section 37.
Yes, sir.
Section 37 extends the provisions of a current statute. That statute prohibits certain folks from lobbying for 1 year after leaving state positions. Currently, it applies to the governor, lieutenant governor, and head of principal department of the executive branch. The committee's bill would extend that post-state employment lobbying restriction, which lasts for only 1 year, to also include deputy heads of departments and employees of the Office of the Governor who are required to file APOC financial disclosure statements. That essentially covers those in policy-making positions in the Office of the Governor. Section 38 of the bill would prohibit the former head of a principal department in the executive branch for 1 year after leaving service from serving on the governing board of a company, organization, or other entity that was regulated by that department or with which the former department head worked as part of official duties. A similar restriction would apply to employees of the Office of the Governor in essentially policy-making positions. Section 39 would supplement the existing list of members of boards and commissions that must file annual financial disclosure statements with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. The governor realized that there were several glaring omissions from that list, and those that we've listed in Section 39 are those that the governor identified as part of an amendment to the original bill that the governor submitted on ethics. Section 40 would require the governor, whenever considering granting executive clemency, to submit a disclosure to the Attorney General in writing of any interest in the clemency action that the governor might have. Then the Attorney General would be required to issue a public determination of whether it was appropriate under the Executive Branch Ethics Act for the governor to take action on that clemency application.
Representative Cockham.
This is one of the things that was sent from this committee looking for a bill to attach itself to. Remember, we had the criminal issue come before us, and then so Representative Lynn finally got it in, parked in the right place.
I finally got in again. This does not prohibit the governor from granting clemency.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Sections 41 through 44 deal with applicability and effective dates and are essentially procedural or technical provisions.
Thank you. If I could just say for this half of the room, what a splendid job the three of you did with the other members of the State Affairs Committee in giving us it's less than perfect and requires some change, and there will be some vigorous debate involved. But what a very impressive document, and I thank you all, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Grunberg, Representative Coghill. Terrific! This color-coded sectional that Reneva developed in your office, Representative Coghill, is very helpful. Jane, we're taking amendments through tomorrow. Is that our intention? Is that right?
I hope you're a little bit flexible.
We're going to be very flexible because that is our process. But I hope that we'll also be respectful of the committee, and that even if the language is not specific, we certainly would like to know the subject matter that amendments are going to address, so that we can our office intends to work early and late to maintain considerable order, but also we're interested in quality of life for our staff this week, and I watched it diminish for your various staffs through the state affairs process, so we're quite mindful of that as we move through this this week.
So
Representative Lynn?
I'll tell you, as chair of the state affairs committee, it's really a pleasure to sit on this committee and watch you chair this, and I get to make a comment, I get to vote yes, get to vote no, and you get to run the show.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, there were several items that we talked about, potential amendments, and I know many times we referenced them back to Representative Coghill. So for clarification for everyone on the committee, do you want each of us to create amendments on the items we brought up, or Representative Coghill, I know there were several you said that you wanted to have further discussion on and had already considered. What, for, you know, saving time and duplication, and what's the most productive way to do this?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
I think the best thing to do is just have each member lay their amendments on the table. And and actually, I would suggest that what I'm intending to do is I'll be a conduit for the administration. I know they had a few amendments that they would like to propose. So
I appreciate that. And I think Representative Coghill, what our office will do is, and this is where it will be helpful to have the amendments or the subject matter come in a timely fashion, is it'll allow Jane to help collate the information so that if we have two amendments that mm-hmm. are on the same lines of text, that we can lay them side by side, decide whether both amendments will be offered, whether they'll be merged, whether one is clearly superior in language and construction to an alternate amendment. So Representative Grunberg, you are in cottage industry, and so I look forward to I look forward to the unique improvements that you will offer. Representative Coghill, if you will be helpful.
Would you bring out our bill, please?
Yeah. Representative Coghill, the thing is, I wasn't joking.
I was.
Representative Coghill, if you will be a conduit for the administration, and Jane, you've been working with Joyce at Ethics, so you have some of the things that that Ethics is particularly concerned about. Brooke, if you've got some things through APOC, if you want to work through Jane, that would be helpful for some of the things that you have. Representative Samuels, I appreciate you being a guardian for the private sector in this because it's an important filtration piece. Representative Holmes, you've got 12 other members besides yourself and Representative Grunberg to query to see what kind of amendments that Representative Book or Representative Gardner will be concerned with. The unique charge that I'm going to be responsible for is looking out for the Newman Rule, as I've discussed, because I'm quite concerned, and I think I share that concern with you, Representative Samuels, as well as with the whole committee, to make sure that a cabinet maker who doesn't have to disclose to all of his competitors what his fee for service is for unique cabinetry is, that we don't bring such scrutiny to the process that we put him out of business with the intention of trying to protect the process from those that might approach it less scrupulously than we would hope for. That's how I see things proceeding going forward, and then we want to schedule public testimony. I would say probably on Wednesday, probably to give the public an opportunity to weigh in, and we may take that up Wednesday and tomorrow also. You think might be helpful. So I think we will probably. Schedule a public testimony for Tuesday and Wednesday so that the public can weigh in. I don't know whether we will take all 2 hours on both days to have the public participate. We may, depending on the degree of activity from the public, open up the process a little bit so that we can blend public testimony with the amendment process and approach this in a less conventional fashion so that we don't exclude either members that we're mindful of the clock and that we don't exclude the public. And Mr. Jones, your expertise is greatly appreciated, so as you have the opportunity to weigh in on this, and Joyce and Brooke, it's a pleasure to have you here in person as opposed to just being available over the phone, so we hope that you will make an effort not only to have an open dialogue with Jane, but I would encourage any of the members that have individual concerns on some of the issues that were raised today to make an appointment in your office to talk to APOC or Ethics as it relates to concerns you may have for other members and their unique needs. And ladies, you're available for members of this committee. And we want to put out an exemplary work product that is respectful of the concerns of the majority, the minority, the public, and respects the central issue that Governor Palin campaigned on, which obviously struck a chord with the public. And at the same time, we want to put out a product that is timely and allows us to take up many more of the pressing issues that are already before this committee that we have blocked out this week for, so that next week we can vigorously pursue those items. Are there any questions or comments from the members? Representative Lynn?
Mr. Chairman, I think all of us in one manner or another campaigned on ethics, and as did the governor.
Yes, sir. All right. Any other counsel or guidelines from any of the members this afternoon? I thought this was very very thorough today. Mr. Jones, thank you very much. Ladies, thank you very much. Representative Coghill?
May I just ask?
Outstanding. Yes, Representative Grunberg?
I would just ask Mr. Jones and Ms. Anderson and Ms. Miles and Ms. Kempton, is there anything else they wanted to talk about today for us to think about since they're here? Through the chair.
Ladies?
Okay. Thank you. Thank
you. All right. Any other
going to get better.
Any other comments? All right. Seeing none, we're adjourned.